But this week I have something completely different, and it really came out of left field. I'm not even sure how they found me, but I was reached out to by Scott Shea and his people to talk about his book, new book, In Good Faith, and its compelling argument against atheism as a philosophical set of tenets for a society and for, at the very least, what we might call Abrahamic, Mosaic faith, faith in a monotheistic God, which is a better way.
I'd like to begin with a trigger warning. Oh,
this is
completely, utterly
mad.
You're God.
Insane.
Genius.
Someone needs to save this man.
If you're doing what everyone else is doing, you're doing it wrong.
One of the greatest epics ever produced.
Well, get ready. You ain't seen nothing yet.
Against atheism as a philosophical set of tenets for a society and for, at the very least, what we might call Abrahamic, Mosaic faith, faith in a monotheistic God, which is a better way for society. Now, Scott's this guy's been around a little bit here. He is a leading businessman and thought leader. Along with the books that he's written, he has founded a bank. And this bank is called, now I had it here in one place, Synergy Bank. Is that correct, Scott?
Signature Bank.
Signature Bank. There you go. In 2001. And your notes here say $46 billion bank, and pioneered and then led this through the great financial meltdown of 2008, 2009. Give you an idea where I was. I was 18-year-old watching my dad's TV, his big screen, when all that went down. You're also the son of a Holocaust survivor, which is fascinating in its own right. And some of your notes here say that you found the meltdown reminding you of your father's stories about the rise of Hitler in Germany. And I wonder if we could just start there, because I think that is a really interesting connection.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. It's really a pleasure to be doing this as part of a book tour for In Good Faith. And the key is, and here's the commonality that links so many things, and I found and really – in a way, the reason I wrote the book is that both on a macro basis and in our intimate encounters with others, we've lost track of the central point of the Bible, which is to overturn idolatry. And most people think idolatry is some sort of quaint and harmless bowing down to statues or believing in pantheons of gods or magic making. But the reality, and you've actually talked about this on your podcast, the reality is the Bible explains this far worse. Idolatry is a set of lies about power. It's about ascribing superpower, super authority to finite beings, certain individuals, ideologies, natural processes, or even in the ancient world, animals. And it's by definition immoral, and it's irrational. It's bad faith. And people think we beat the God King Pharaoh 3,300 years ago, and that was that. But the whole 20th century was a catalog of God King Pharaohs, Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot, etc. And and it's not just, and they all use, by the way, the same tropes of pageantry and poetry and theater and the like. All backed up, of course, with demonstration of brutal power. And the thing I found is that this, and this is in a way why I wrote the book, it doesn't just happen on a macro basis. It also happens in our encounters with individuals. It happens so often on Wall Street. I saw it so very often on Wall Street where people set themselves up as idols, where they are unquestioned and unquestionable. And they amass super authority over whatever else they ought to, you know, regular power and authority they ought to have. And so I really felt that the Bible's message was as relevant as ever for business people, and as relevant as ever, you know, and looking unfortunate for better or for worse at our geopolitical situation.
Now, as I toss footballs at you here, feel free to just kind of, you know, throw it right back at me if it crosses any lines. But I want to make sure for my listeners that they understand too, because you just said a lot of things that like I completely agree with and I find really interesting. There's so much we could talk about. We're not going to have time to do it. But you are coming at this from a different perspective than most of my audience, being a Hebrew descent, right? Child of Abraham. But then also, yes. Therefore, a practicing Jew, which you can't say that about everybody of Hebrew descent these days, and a pious and, from what I can tell, a conservative practicing Jew, correct?
Well, I consider myself observant. I try to avoid labels, but I'm Sabbath observant. I keep kosher. So I would consider myself an observant Jew.
And you attend, let me put it this way then maybe. You attend a synagogue in which the belief is that Moses was a real guy. He actually did kind of lead the people of Israel out of Egypt across the Red Sea, that kind of thing?
I believe in a God who doesn't deceive. So if the Bible says that there's a real Moses, I mean, I don't see anything, and that's one of the sections of the book. I see nothing that contradicts the Bible after, which is written to be consistent with history. It's not a history book. But after the first 11 chapters, which I think are, you know, clearly allegorical, and the Bible says they're allegorical, after that, you know, I definitely think that what the Bible says is true, and although it's, you know, uses metaphor and it uses perhaps, you know, the same sort of hyperbole that people do in many other instances, but I certainly believe in the reality that a real Moses existed, a real Samuel existed, a real David, a real Solomon, etc.
Yeah. Excellent, excellent. And just fair disclosure, I would probably be called a literalist when it comes to those early chapters of Genesis, but we don't have to chase that at all right now. What I find important in this is that many of the arguments you make do not require that you believe the Bible in the way you just described or in the way that I would describe. This is in some ways much bigger than that. It's something that can be agreed upon by, say, any other monotheist, someone of Islamic belief or what have you. And that idolatry is this problem of our need as humans to put our trust in something that's not God and our will to defend that really to the death or to the murder of others. And so I want to come back to that. As a Lutheran Christian, we have this thing we talk about called original sin. And we refer to that as both what Adam did that ruined us and then what we have inherited from him. And you described it so well with this idea of the human default being to trust in promises built upon material things. Can you talk more about that and your view on that?
Sure. And I think you're really, again, nailing it. I mean, people lose track of what the Bible came to do, which is the world was an idolatrous world where people believed that individuals could make magic, could control the world. And, you know, that's the whole story of Pharaoh, is that until those five courageous women stood up, everybody took whatever Pharaoh said as truth. And so they would throw be willing to throw Israelite baby boys into the Nile, murder anybody that Pharaoh said to murder, do whatever Pharaoh said to do. And the amazing thing about an idolatrous society is even idolaters start to think that what they say is truth. I mean, for example, when Pharaoh, the two Egyptian midwives are just remarkably courageous women, but they understand idolatry because Pharaoh says, Pharaoh says to the midwives, when you're giving birth to them, you know, strangle them, kill them, do something that means that the Israelite baby boys aren't alive. And here's the amazing thing. First of all, the Israelite midwives, I'm sorry, the Egyptian midwives lie to Pharaoh. They stand up, even though they know that the risk is that if they're caught, they'll be murdered too. But they do it in a way that takes advantage of Pharaoh's misconception of the world with idolatry. They say to him, oh, we can't do this because the Israelite women give birth. And it's interesting, the Hebrew word is chiyot, like animals. It's the chaya means animal in Hebrew. And so they tell the Pharaoh, the Israelite women are just like animals. They're not like you and me. They're not us good Egyptian stock people. They come from a separate God. They're a separate people. They're animals. And the amazing thing is Pharaoh believes them. He doesn't kill the midwives. So idolaters start to even believe their own lies, and that leaves societies in terrible places where if you don't like the other folks, you don't even consider them human. They're not sons and daughters of the same God. So,
yeah, when you believe the mythology, go ahead.
Let me just make one more point. So what happened in the sits my father, who was a Holocaust survivor who survived Dachau with weighing 60 pounds, and we can talk about that more, his story, which is a remarkable story. But how did Hitler convince people to just murder Jews? Well, he said they were vermin. They're not human. They're not human beings. And that's what every idolater says. Hitler said he was his own god king, just like Pharaoh and Mao and Stalin and Pol Pot. And if you were part of the Aryan god king, you know, ideology nation, you followed Hitler, you did whatever he said, and everybody else didn't matter. And so very, very fundamentally, it goes back to what you're saying, the beginning of the Bible, which is God says that we're all created B'Tselem Elohim in Hebrew, in the image of God. We're all equal. We're all sons and daughters. That's what, you know, that's the whole way the Bible starts, is we all have a spark of divinity within us. So we have to look at others as though they are worthy. They are, you know, in philosophical terms, ontologically equal. Their beings are the same as ours. And idolatry takes you to the exact opposite way. And it also, by the way, takes you to the exact opposite way, and this is where it came from Wall Street, but I'm going to just give you a little diversion, if you will, because it's so timely, is that how did people like Kevin Spacey and Harvey Weinstein and Matt Lauer and Charlie Rose get away with what they got away with? Because they set themselves up as idols. And so other people weren't equal to them. They didn't go by the golden rule. If they could dominate other people, if they could get away with it through lies about power, which is how I defined idolatry, then okay. And so many people do that day to day. And that's what made me feel like I really needed to write this book.
So many good threads in there. I already am hoping you'll be on and chat with me again sometime so we can follow things like your father's story. When you mentioned the ontological equality of mankind, I mean, there are some big words, but it's so well said that we are in God's image and created all of deep value to him. I believe the way Jesus says, you know, you are of more value than many sparrows. And Saul of Tarsus, who I would call St. Paul these days, he says in a letter he writes to a young man named Timothy that the false teacher, who must be an idolater, he is deceiving and being deceived. And that's very much what you were talking about there, that you start to believe your own lie. You start to believe your own mythology. And in order to prop that up and justify what you believe about yourself, you will go to all sorts of ends that maybe you wouldn't have done way back at the beginning. Now, I want to shift here to those who are teaching this mythology. You tell a little story about the protective instincts of a father for his children when they went off to college. I would just love to chat about that more in general, but you dropped this name, Yuval Harari, author of a couple of books, Sapiens, Homo Deus, member of the New Atheist Rock Stars, all that kind of stuff, a friend of Sam Harris, who, fair disclosure, I like Sam Harris when he teaches mindfulness meditation. When he talks about religion, I don't care as much. Yuval Harari and Sapiens, that's a book that I had heard recommended by another guy I followed, not Christian, purely secular, business stuff, Tim Ferriss. And I picked it up and I could barely even get through the first chapter before I was just so disgusted I put it down. So what happened with your kids at college with this name and that information that made you, well, pick up a sword, really, in a sense, sort of the word? What went on there and what do we need to know?
Well, look, here's the thing about Yuval Harari, is he's a nihilist. He essentially doesn't think that there's any common spark of humanity among us. I mean, his second book, Homo Deus, says, you know, basically, you know, deifying man, deifying people. And, you know, every time we deify people, that's when the real horrors of humanity start. And that's why I am so friggin' concerned about people reading Yuval Harari as though it is the Bible. I can't tell you how many parents have told me that they've given their children my book after they read Sapiens, because Sapiens essentially says everything was an accident in humanity. We just sort of got here the way we got here. But democracy doesn't matter because we're too easily manipulated. Indeed, we aren't all ontologically equal. We aren't all don't have the same being. We're not equivalent human beings. Some people can manipulate others. He says we're going to get our gods, our new gods, from Silicon Valley. I mean, it is such smooth atheism. I mean, such smooth idolatry. It's not atheism anymore. And that's what really concerns me. And he sold 30 million books because people don't get anymore what idolatry is. And that's pure, simple idolatry. I wrote a review of his 21 lessons, which people can easily find online. And when you boil it down, you find a lot of folks who are very facile with language. Yuval Harari is a great writer, but it doesn't make sense. I mean, it's so many fundamental levels, it doesn't make sense. But once you get indoctrinated into the lies of idolatry, then it makes perfect sense. And that's why the Bible, in my view, is still super, it's as relevant today as it was 3,300 years ago.
Yeah.
And people are reading it because the answers are there.
But when you're looking for a way to justify your own hunger for hedonism, for whatever you want against another, any mythology and any idolatry, same thing in my mind, is going to be something you'll latch onto with a vigor because it defends your mental self acceptance, right? And we definitely see that today. Excuse me. Touching on this idea that atheism isn't atheism, that it's a religion, that it's a spirituality. I think that is so true. One of my favorite is not really – oh, it never works. But one of my favorite apologetic or intellectual defense things to do with atheists is to talk about why they trust in reason so much, since to have reason be reasonable, you have to take that on faith, more or less. You can't prove it. You can't test that in a laboratory. You just have to assume it's true. So there is a religious aspect even to the hardest atheist. But the lack of acceptance that it is a spirituality is maybe the most fascinating thing, that they keep wanting to pretend, oh no, this is all just science, but it really isn't. And it sounds like out of what you're getting from Haval, it's really well beyond science. So maybe can you still talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, let me talk about people do. I gave a book talk at Google, which was a lot of fun. And most of the people there, a lot of people there, both in the recorded questions and answers, as well as even more so for a long time afterward, were really saying to me, why do we need God anymore? We don't need God. We have reason. And reason is sufficient. Kant is sufficient, et cetera. And I got the same question maybe 20 times, because I do think among a lot of, not all, but, you know, a chunk of millennial Gen Zers who have gone to college and have been told when they go to college that, don't worry, you're in college now. We can teach you how to get over the superstitions of your parents and in this God sort of thing. And so they are taught that reason is sufficient. But reason, and this is what I've tried to explain to people, reason can lead you to all sorts of bad, bad places. Let me give you a few examples. This is a real example, actually. I'll give you a real example. Peter Singer. You may have heard of him.
Oh, yeah.
Your listeners may have heard of him. Peter Singer is an atheist, believes in a moral philosophy of pure reason. And so he, like Richard Dawkins, thinks that it is okay to kill infants under the age of one or two if they are severely disabled or disabled, and he would certainly be the judge of what that means, because it requires tremendous resources from society. So I know through the business world, the medical director of a major U.S. insurance company, who told me that, yes, if we eliminated all but routine care for people below 30 days old and above some, let's say, age like 75. So all you got was routine care before and after that. We could save at least 20% of all healthcare expenditures in the United States.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. You could actually send everyone to college for free for that. You could do a lot of things. Now, Peter Singer and other rational moral philosophers would say, quote-unquote rational, reasoned, quote-unquote, would say that calculus makes sense. It's based on empirical data, reason. It's based on logic. And therefore, it should be actioned. Now, people who are relatives or actually are above 75 or above, well, you know, we have to protect children under 30 days, but people who fit into those categories may object, but that doesn't matter, because you could argue from a variety of reasons, ways, you know, moral deontology, you could argue from utilitarianism, you know, the greatest good for the greatest number, that, well, it's the greatest good for the greatest number. People can go to college, people can live better lives, we'll have lower deficits. If you don't believe that everyone shares the same spark of godliness, then you'll go down that road. By the way, the first ever textbook of quote-unquote medical ethics was written in Nazi Germany, where the book says, you know, for the good of the nation, people who are – I actually cite this in my book – people who are vegetables or people who require the constant assistance of other, you know, well-bodied Germans are a burden on society and therefore should be, you know, quote-unquote, humanely euthanized because it's a waste of resources. We should, you know, make healthy people healthier, but we shouldn't take care of the sick. And this was actually taught. Now, again, if you don't believe that people are equal, if you don't believe that we share all, as I say in Hebrew, B'Tselem Elokim, we don't share a spark of divinity, then, you know what, that makes sense. Let's just, if my group or your group or whoever the alpha group is, has the power, why not take on more resources, more power, because just like Machiavelli, you know, just crush the other side. Make sure you cripple the other side so they can't respond. There's no good and evil. There's no good and bad. there's no God, so there's no reward and punishment. That's the train they had Sam Harris and Yuval Harari and Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins want us to get on. And ultimately, that becomes a struggle for having the most power. And, you know, again, as I said, then that morphs quickly into idolatry because you end up deifying yourself, deifying your group, because you clearly are more important than everybody else. You know, whether you're Mao or Charlie Rose or whoever, you're clearly more important than everybody else. So if you have power, use it.
That brings me back to something I've had circled on my notes here for a while. And you brought it up earlier and I've keep coming back to it and thinking, huh, I use this phrase from Nietzsche to describe what I think is the entire ethos of the postmodern zeitgeist, right? The will to power. That really, once you have removed the authority of a divine creator with an established set of moral truths, tenets, natural truths, these are not separate from nature. They are part of nature. When you've removed that concept, all that remains is, well, survival of the fittest, the one who is strongest. And as Nietzsche, I think, rightly understood in that mindset, the one who is emotionally, willfully ready to do what it takes to get what he wants. What you mentioned Kevin Spacey earlier, what was so interesting to me, not about his fall from Hollywood grace, but the character he was portraying at that very time, the irony of kicking a guy out when he's like playing himself on the, you know, as the president. But that, I'm losing his name now, the character lived will to power. And he really did. I mean, every moment, every second, he did what he needed to do in order to do what he wanted. And I found that fascinating. I think we were all stunned and had to keep watching that show, those of us who were into it, to see, I mean, will he ever give up? Will he ever break? But the thing is, as you point out, that requires that you trample others. It requires that you leave in your wake a great deal of pain and suffering. Now, what I wonder here is, assume I'm an atheist for a second. And I don't agree with you at all. And I don't believe that there is a value in human life because I think we're all more or less blobs of cells that have just kind of come happenstancely into existence and have this thing we think is thought, right? How would you try then to convince me that that's just a completely ludicrous idea from a natural argument? I mean, if you can do it without just saying, you know, the Bible, right? Or God says, right? How would you go about that?
So first of all, here's what I say to you. Here's what I say to a lot of people, and that's been this wonderful thing about book tours. I'm getting to meet all sorts of people. Is I'm meeting a lot of atheists, and I'm meeting them, and I try to meet them on even footing.
Yeah.
Because I am willing, and I say this to people, and I actually enjoy speaking to atheists because, you know, actually atheism does monotheism a service because it exposes where monotheists become idolaters, and unfortunately that happens all too often. So I put people into four general categories. Monotheists, people who share the idea that we have a spark, we all share a spark of divinity. Then, sadly, idolaters who wear monotheistic garb, and there are unfortunately too many, who use monotheism and sort of weaponize it for their own benefit. And they're essentially self-deifiers. And unfortunately, we've seen too many folks who claim to be religious. They're not really monotheists. They're religion is themselves. And those folks are risky, and you have to be on the lookout for that. And then on the atheist side, I also divide that in two ways. And here, it's whether or not, and I put it in atheist terms, not whether or not they believe in the spark of divinity that we all share, but whether or not atheists believe in the golden rule. And the way Hillel said it, and it's also Jesus says it and said a lot of ways, it's said in the Hebrew scriptures, but essentially the way Hillel said it was, don't do unto others what you wouldn't want done unto you. It's the golden rule, you know, treat your neighbor, treat your friend, treat your person, as do unto others as you would do unto you. I like the negative way because I think it's the most conservative, small c, and I think it almost, and it works. I've never found really a situation where it doesn't work. So atheists who embrace the golden rule, don't do unto someone else what you wouldn't want done unto you. So that means you can't put yourself in a situation where you're oppressing other people, where you're doing something to someone else that's unfair. It's just because of your own whim. You can't do that. Then I can make common cause and have no problem making common cause with atheists who are golden rule adherents. Where I can't make golden common cause and where I think atheism is really, really dangerous is where you don't believe in the golden rule. Again, the Yuval Harari, Richard Dawkins version of atheism where if I can amass power, why not? There's no purpose or point in the universe. I may as well just take whatever I can take and manipulate whoever I can manipulate. And actually, when I have that conversation with atheists, I see people's eyes open wide.
Yeah, sure.
Because they don't get the fundamental bridge between the golden rule and being created in the image of God. And then the other thing that I do, you know, in all candor is sometimes just to get people thinking is, you know, everybody talks about these great luminaries of the of reason and how, you know, the Enlightenment and Steven Pinker wrote Enlightenment Now. And then I just quote a few people from the Enlightenment, like Kant, who said, the Negroes of Africa have by nature no feeling that rises above a trifling.
Hmm.
Or Voltaire said, you Jews have surpassed all nations in impertinent fables and bad conduct. You deserve to be punished. That is your destiny. Or, I don't know, I can pick some others. Like Voltaire again, that, you know, governments need to be butchers. And it goes on and on. And the sexism of Kant and the sexism of Voltaire say continually that men should make orders and women should obey. I mean, they're so sexist, so racist. It's amazing. And this is where we get our Enlightenment reason thinkers. And if you scratch most reasoning, you know, for reason-based philosophers, if you go too far, you can definitely find some sort of prejudice. The Bible doesn't allow that. The Bible says we're all created in the image of God. We all have that humanity. We all share that divinity. And we have to treat each other along the lines of that divinity. And if you just make that, flip that switch, then, boy, it changes everything.
I want to take a moment here and address that spark of divinity concept, because in the history of Christianity, that language has become sort of a technical no-no term. And so I don't know whether or not you're meaning what they're meaning, but I'm going to try it for my listeners' sake to kind of put it in what I think and I agree with, which is that being created in the image of God, God has set mankind apart from the rest of nature, steward, head, caretaker, lover, but also part of it. And we all share that, and it makes us we wouldn't say sparks of God, but we would say creatures of God. And I guess all creation is that too, so maybe I'm wrestling here a little bit to salvage it. What we don't believe on my end here is that God is literally inhabiting every human being spiritually at this point. And the reason for that is because of the fall and the curse and all that stuff from Genesis 3. And again, we don't have to chase that. But what you're advocating here, again, is something we do agree with, that we are ontologically equal. Right. And that to believe that about ourselves, even that individual who at 75 is wheelchair bound or worse, who maybe can't even think for themselves, that to bring to bear, I think as I like the way Moses said it, love your neighbor as yourself, right? To bring to bear that kind of not just ethic, but faith, really, this trust in what goodness is something we can make common ground with those we disagree on other things about. And I find it super interesting then. So what do you think about this? You're talking with these atheists at Google. God bless you for getting into Google. That's great. You're talking with these atheists at Google, and you bring up the Golden Rule, and you find that some of them believe in it, which I find really fascinating. Where'd that come from? How did they get that idea? Yeah. It certainly wasn't from their philosophical positions. Is it a natural thing most humans assume? Is it the relics of a monotheistic culture? But then when you show them that that's what's going to be destroyed by their philosophical positions, now they have to think twice about what they assume to be true. It's great stuff there. What do you think?
Well, first of all, if you want to see, the Google Talk is Googleable. All you have to do is put in my name in Google Talk. So
that's cool.
It was really a fascinating, and I enjoyed the whole experience. It was one of those experiences that, you know, really was a tremendous highlight. First of all, when it comes to God, what I've learned is all I'm really trying to do is to get people to think, because belief, the stakes in belief are just so high that the switch rarely turns so quickly for people to believe it or not believe, at least in my personal experience. I don't know about you're a reverend, you're a clergy member, so you may talk to people in different settings. In the settings I talk to people, the stakes are very high because it does switch your whole outlook on life, going from just thinking that you're a clump of carbon that happened to come together because of some highly unlikely, probably highly unlikely happenstances in the multiverse, as opposed to believing that life has meaning and purpose, and that there's a God above, thinking and looking at what we do and worried about us or concerned about us. It's such a major league mindset switch that it's not something that happens very easily for people. So my goal is a much smaller one, which is to just get atheists to recognize that it is rational to believe in the God of the Bible. With all we know about science, all we know about the historicity of the Bible, and all we know about modern morality, and indeed that modern morality is wanting when compared to the morality of the Bible. And I go through this in the book. There are obviously, we don't have time for it, there are obviously a whole bunch of parts of the Bible that, you know, are problematic on first read. But if I can just get people to recognize that it's rational to believe in God, that it makes sense to believe in God. You may not believe in God. That's also rational, by the way. Atheism is rational. It is possible that we are clumps of carbon that came together by happenstance. I don't think that makes sense.
That's
highly unlikely.
Exactly.
But it's not irrational.
Sure.
And so I don't claim that people are rational. Now, you know, look, that's a different perspective than Harris and others who believe that you're stupid if you believe in God. Literally say that, you know, you're clearly just clinging to the superstitions of your parents, as I was talking about before, clinging to facile magical thinking I mean, that's what most atheists come at. They think they dismiss belief before they even question it, before they even engage with it. And, you know, and that's what I really try to get, you know, and these are perfectly, you know, smart people like Sam Harris who does that.
Right, right. I've gotten comments before from my YouTube stuff from guys who come in and they'll say, I don't understand. How can you possibly be saying all this? You seem so intelligent. Why are you saying these things? And it's kind of like, well, maybe just listen to what I actually said then and think about it a little bit rather than insult me and call me stupid, because the best argument they can come up with, it is rational to believe that. That point, I find myself making that argument more and more. Last night I was just, I say yelling, not really yelling, but being very zealous with my little confirmation class about that very issue, that this is not an irrational thing, whether, well, for what I was telling them last night, to believe that God exists, that he's almighty, to believe that we're fallen, that means he has to destroy us, to believe that he doesn't want to destroy us, and so he's endeavored to save us, and for us Christians, that of course brings it to who Jesus is. With just a few moments left here and wanting to make sure I respect your time, do you mind if I turn the corner here a little bit and throw you some quick shots? These are questions I like to ask guests who come from kind of random corners of the world. They kind of connect, they kind of don't. You can just say nah to any one of them. But you know, they're not intended to be long questions here. The first one is just, did you have a favorite verse in the Bible, and what is it, and you know, kind of why?
Yeah, well, it is the golden rule in Hebrew. It's "Behavta karecha kamocha," love your neighbor as yourself.
And do you have a favorite non-Bible quote that you find yourself coming back to again and again?
I do. If it was easy, everybody'd be doing it.
Say something about that. That's great. What is that?
Well, I mean, everything is, you know, I think that, and this does come from a biblical perspective. I think the Bible tells us that life is a series of challenges, tests, questions for us to answer. And it's not always easy. You know, this is another thing. I mean, God doesn't always make things easy. That's not obviously the point. The point is figuring out what needs to be done and figuring out how we can exert the effort to do it.
I love that grit.
And that's different for everybody.
Yeah, but the grit is such a good thing. At the end of your day, how do you measure success? Success is a word people have different definitions, so you don't have to worry about that so much. Just for you, it was a good day. How do you come to that? What has to happen for that?
You know, I'd like to feel that in some small way, I brought the world a little closer to redemption, and that may be by something, an interaction with a human being. That may be by something I do in the communal world. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of days I don't feel that way.
Yeah, I tell you, the list gets longer every afternoon, it seems, of what I haven't yet quite finished. And so I hear you on that. Is there a major idea that you have changed your mind about in the last few years?
Boy, I do change my mind about all sorts of things, in business and in, you know, in politically. But I think that's probably a longer conversation, so I'll pass on that.
Yeah, sure.
I do change my mind, though, a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's what you have to do.
I find it curious when it's a big thing that really shifts your directions. It can say a lot about, I think, tenets of nature. A lot of times it's something that's important for all of us if it was big enough to move somebody. So super kind of out of the blue question maybe here, and this can be from a book, this can be from a movie, doesn't matter, but fiction preferably. Do you have a favorite bad guy, a favorite antagonist who you just love to hate and who you find yourself fascinated by in stories?
Well, you know, I watched the Avengers movie.
Yeah.
I think the bad guy is Thanos.
Yeah, yeah.
The big bad guy. And you know, here's the funny thing, and this is maybe why he's quote unquote my favorite bad guy. You know, I talk to millennials on this book tour who say, well, Thanos had the right idea. Cut everybody back by 50% and there'll be more. The universe will be, will be able to use its resources better. Things will be better. And I realized, boy, like the purest form of idolatry there is. And so I'm more amused by it than anything else, but I'm blown away.
I'm with you, too.
There are a lot of people who think, well, the world would be better if there were half the people. Boy, that's idolatry.
Well, watching that movie, I was blown away that we had Hollywood make a movie that decried that philosophy so clearly as evil. Because if you listen to him, he makes perfect sense. You can't really argue with him unless you believe humanity just has something actually special about it. So I oh man, you're really singing my tune right there when you go to Thanos. Okay, this one's tougher, and we have about, looks like, 3 minutes before you have to go. So feel free to wander on this, or I got one more I can throw you to shift it if you don't want to do this. But is there a time in your life when a failure happened that you thought was ruinous, but actually became one of the most important learning points or changes in your life? And if so, what was it, and then how? What did it do?
Well, there are a lot of points where I thought, gee, this is bad when it was really good, or this is good, and unfortunately times when it wasn't so good. I'll give you one story that I've told. It's not in my book or anything, but where you don't know whether how something's going to turn out. Early in my career, I ended up. I was young. I was working on Wall Street. I was at Salomon Brothers, and I was told to be. I needed to go with one of our partners down to Florida to make a presentation. And this fellow, Lou Ranieri, said, okay, let's take the 9 p.m. flight, Eastern flight at the time, this will date it a little bit, down to Florida. So I went down, and to make a long story short, we ended up trying to take off, having to go back, going back again. We ended up being on this flight from 9 p.m. until 6 a.m. Before we made it to Florida. It was the most unpleasant, you would have thought, flight, just, you know, sort of your nightmare scenario of flying. And yet, by doing that, I got to know Lou Ranieri, who was father in the mortgage market, who changed the direction of my career. We bonded essentially for life. This is now, you know, 30 plus years later, we're the best friends. And who would have thought that this nightmare flight, we ended up taking essentially a red-eye from Newark to LaGuardia and had an emergency landing with all the emergency equipment. They foamed the runway. Yes. I mean, it could not have gone much worse other than the flight actually crashing. And yet it ended up being a tremendous power. It changed my life. My friendship with him has been, you know, very, very important to me, and certainly changed the direction of my business career. So you never know is the bottom line. You got to try to look for the good and the not so good.
Yeah, that each failure is an opportunity. I'm a big fan recently of a guy named Jocko Willink, retired Navy SEAL, a business consultant. He's got this little 2-minute thing on YouTube called Good. Like, whatever life throws at it, you just say good. Because there's something that'll come out of it, and if you're still breathing, well, then you got a chance to fight back. So, your business career, your father's story, Scott. I would love to ask about those things and the details and stories at some time. So, if you'd be willing to be back on in the future, I'll send an email to your people, and I'd love to have you on again. Scott Shea is the author of In Good Faith: Questioning Religion and Atheism, and it's won numerous awards. It's got people like Barney Frank, an atheist and former congressman, saying, "I can't think of another book with which I disagree so strongly that has engaged me so deeply." I wrote down some other names that have people that have reviewed this who are important. But the point is, it is making waves. You can find him by Googling Scott Shea, spelled S-H-A-Y. Plenty of information there. And it sounds like for Christian, for Jew, for Muslim, if you're talking apologetics, this is a good hit to go to right now. So where can people find, besides your website, is there somewhere that people can find you, Twitter, Facebook, or whatever, where they can follow your stuff?
They can. ScottShea.com is the best way to find me, and actually people can even write to me. There's an information form, and that comes to me too. So I post everything from the Google Talk to I did a debate with Michael Shermer, who's an atheist. It's posted. So most of the stuff that I do gets posted, and if you'd like, I'll post this podcast.
Oh, please do. Please do, because my audience, I think, is smaller than your audience. So I'm certainly willing to let it fly out there into the world. And I know your people found me, so they must be able to find it. So, well, thank you for your time. Thank you for reaching out. This has been enjoyable. I think the meeting of minds is fascinating, and iron sharpens iron, all that kind of stuff. So thank you, and rock on, yeah?
Thank you, and I really did have this. Really did have a great time on your podcast. And if you want to invite me back, I'll be happy to do it.
Oh, absolutely!
All good things.
Yeah, rock on then.
There's more.
City's inhabitants are losing their minds.
Trigger warning. This ain't a safe space.
Insanity.
By going.
Yes, completely, utterly.
Genius. If you're doing what everyone else is doing, you're doing it
mad.
Was that worth a dollar? Click the Patreon link in the show notes to sign up. Pretty please?